China's Belt and Road Initiative, sometimes referred to as the New Silk Road, is one of the most ambitious infrastructure projects ever conceived. Launched in 2013 by President Xi Jinping, the vast collection of development and investment initiatives would stretch from East Asia to Europe, significantly expanding China's economic and political influence. Some analysts see the project as an unsettling extension of China's rising power. And as the costs of many of the projects have skyrocketed, opposition has grown in some countries. Meanwhile, the United States shares the concern of some in Asia that the project could be a Trojan horse for China-led regional development and military expansion. Under President Donald J. Trump, Washington has raised alarm over Beijing's actions, but it has struggled to offer governments in the region a more appealing economic vision. That 2020 assessment of China's ongoing Belt and Road Initiative comes from the Council on Foreign Relations and highlights the promise and the suspicion that come with a major aspect of China's foreign policy. What are China's ambitions, and how successful has U.S. foreign policy been in dealing with them? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Judd Kinsley, professor of history at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks very much for having me.
China, it's obviously a very large part of the globe and really always has been, but it's also had a very significantly changing, almost 180-degree changing relationship with the United States over the years, hasn't it?
It has. And I think that, you know, what we're looking at today is substantially different than it was, you know, under the Mao era from 1949 to his death in 1976. Things have changed pretty substantially. And they changed before that as well. So we're looking at, you know, a series of changes over time.
The first thing we think of probably in U.S.-China relations is trade, going back into the 19th century and the opening up of Japan, for example. What was the experience with China?
Well, the U.S. or the Chinese experience with the United States in many cases has been sort of filtered through the experiences under Western imperialism in China and in East Asia more generally, as you talk about Japan as well. But you know, the United States has been pretty closely connected to the larger Western imperial project in East Asia since the 19th century. And I think what we see, you know, really from, you know, the 18th century and into the 19th is that the United States is seeking certain kinds of trading opportunities and open trading opportunities in East Asia and in China in particular. And a lot of that has been, in many cases, has been connected to British imperial efforts to open up new trading ports in China in the 19th century. You know, the experiences in the post-Opium War period with the various treaties, the United States was involved in a lot of that treaty making and trying to stake out new opportunities in China in the 19th century. So that's – I would say that a lot of the, you know, American engagement with China in the 19th century in particular has been really connected to a larger Western imperial project. And I think what's interesting about some of that is that the United States often tried to suggest that it was quite different than some of the imperial powers. So unlike the British or the French, American diplomats or merchants seemed to suggest they weren't operating under the same sort of imperial framework. In fact, I think a lot of the literature on American-Chinese relations in the 19th century points to the fact that despite this sort of rhetoric, China and the United States have operated within the framework of Western imperialism in a lot of really important ways.
What was the United States after not colonizing China? I'm not sure that other than Hong Kong and maybe Macau and maybe a couple other fairly isolated places, there was that much colonization of China by anybody, was there?
No, there wasn't. I mean, it wasn't, as you say, beyond Macau by the Portuguese and Hong Kong by the British, there wasn't much overt colonization. I mean, we tend to talk about China as a semi-colony. And semi-colony refers typically to the idea of economic exploitation by the Western imperial powers, the desire to extract certain kinds of economic opportunities through trade. and the domination of international trade by the foreign powers in the 19th century in particular.
What kind of products are we after and what are the Chinese going to get in return?
Well, what the United States was after was being able to market certain kinds of American products in the 19th century, market certain kinds of American products, but also through the sale of products that were in demand in China. And so, you know, the typical story in the 19th century in thinking about imperialism is the Western European and North American demand for tea. And tea really sits at the center of this larger trade regime in the 19th century as, you know, demand for tea in the American colonies, but also in Western Europe, prompts sort of an outgrowth of you know, trade outgrowth into China. So the larger story about the opium wars and Western imperialism tends to be that in order to counterbalance the demand for trade, Western Europe and the British in particular looked for certain products that they could exchange for tea. And ultimately they come to opium, which much of which was grown in the British context in British India. So in the end, you have a desire to market large amounts of Indian opium by the British or Turkish opium, often by American traders, in exchange for Chinese luxury products, often for Chinese luxury products. So things like tea, but also porcelains, silk, and those kind of products.
Was there a significant middle or upper class in China that could benefit from this trade?
There were Chinese merchants who were benefiting from that trade. There's also, I mean, one of the kind of important stories about opium in particular is that the ways in which the opium trade sort of helped fuel black market, semi-legal or illegal organizations, bandit groups and what have you in the 19th century. And that really continues throughout the 19th century and into the early 20th. So I think that there are, you know, economic opportunities for Chinese traders as well. I mean, there is a certain – I think there's an important element of exploitation that we need to focus on. But at the same time, that's not to say that there aren't Chinese agents that were making, you know, significant amounts of money off this trade as well. I mean, I think one of the really important sort of stories here is thinking about what they call compradors. So people who are based in treaty ports or trading ports with the West, Chinese who were able to sort of serve as intermediaries for the production of certain kinds of Chinese commodities for sale for American or Western European Western European goods. And so these compradors play this really critical role in linking together Western Europeans and North Americans with, you know, Chinese hinterlands and Chinese producers. And so they're able to get quite wealthy off of this trade for sure.
Was Shanghai essentially a Western port? Was it just kind of created by Westerners for trade?
It is. After the First Opium War, it is open to trade to Western trade. So previously, before 1842 and the Treaty of Nanjing, which ended the First Opium War, all trade to the Qing Empire was filtered through the city of Canton or Guangzhou in Chinese in South China. The Opium War in many ways is intended to open China up to further trade, and Shanghai was one of these initial ports that is open to Western trade. And it was a relatively small, you know, fishing village prior to its opening as a treaty port. And after that, it sort of grows and becomes this major metropolitan center over the course of the 19th century, not only because of British trade, also because of patterns of migration in China that are connected to various rebellions in the mid-19th century, which drives in large numbers of China's rural poor into Shanghai. But its wealth and its sort of center as an imperial metropole really does come from Western capital and from its establishment as a Western treaty port in the 19th century.
How did the opium wars come about, and were they to the advantage of the Western powers?
The opium wars certainly were. So you have the First Opium War in 1839, which, as I said, was intended to open the geographic scope of Western trade. So beyond the city of Guangzhou in the far south of China, the opium wars were intended to open new treaty ports or to open new trading ports for the Western powers, which would allow them to get closer to production sites of porcelain or production sites of tea deeper in the interior. So the desire was to be able to access certain kinds of Chinese products more directly, to not have to go through as many intermediaries in order to get lower prices and to be able to make more economic sense. So the first Opium War does open new treaty ports, allows the British to occupy the island of Hong Kong, and various other concessions. And the second Opium War further opens China, increases the number of treaty ports that are being opened to Western foreign trade. It legalizes opium, and it sort of creates new sort of economic opportunities for the Western imperial powers to be able to profit off the China trade in a much more direct and significant way.
Who is fighting whom in the Opium Wars?
So the first Opium War is the British, and the second is the British in conjunction with the French. So the
British fighting the Chinese?
Fighting the Chinese, yeah, correct. So I guess more specifically fighting the Qing Empire, the force of the Qing Empire.
What were the British after, and what was the Qing Empire after in these Opium Wars?
I mean, I would say that the British are after trading opportunities, you know, seeing the potential profit in the tea trade and various luxury goods. There are opportunities for profit. And so the opium trade is initially controlled by the British East India Company. And so this is a state-funded operation that is devoted to generating profit for the British East India Company and thus for the Crown. For the British, there is a desire to profit. That's sort of what they're seeking. I mean, for the Qing Empire, there's a concern about opening China up too much to foreign influence, and it's not necessarily out of xenophobia, but it's more out of a concern that, you know, China is this sort of really important economic power in the 18th century, and China is one of the most powerful empires in the world in the 18th century. There's a fear from the Qing court, from the emperor, that if they start giving certain kinds of trading rights to this realm, who's to say every other realm in East Asia isn't going to be demanding similar kinds of trade rights? And then that would create a certain amount of chaos and would create certain potential social and economic problems for the Qing court. And so So the Qing court in many ways is trying to hold the line to create some kind of restrictions on Western trade. So what you see happening over the course of the 19th century are a series of wars that are undertaken by the imperial powers, British and later the British and the French, and later even other imperial powers, the French again in the 1880s and then Japan in 1895. But their desire to open up China more and more to Western, or I should say more broadly, imperial capital for investment, the circulation of missionaries, the opening of new treaty ports, all of these things are part of a larger package that the imperial powers are demanding from the Qing court in the 19th century. And so when the Qing court resists sort of the opening of the Qing Empire to more and more outside influence, the ways in which the foreign powers are able to make their demands stick is through wars and the treaties that end those wars.
A familiar story. So the Opium Wars were destabilizing the Qing Empire?
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. There's some debate among historians about the extent to which the first Opium War was truly sort of this transformative moment for the Qing. But I think it's pretty safe to say that by the second Opium War, which saw not only the defeat of Qing forces in North China, but also the burning of the emperor's summer palace outside of Beijing, these are sort of transformative and sort of critical moments for the Qing, forcing it to sort of recognize the technological, at least, superiority of the Western forces and the need to bring in certain types of Western technology and potentially military tactics in order to allow them to be able to compete with the West.
Was there pressure exerted on China, the Qing Empire, by the British in order to get that 99-year lease on Hong Kong?
Well, there was in the Opium War. So essentially in the 1830s, the British wanted what the Portuguese had, which was an anchorage off the coast of China to be able to, you know, get water and food for their ships before they – after making the long sea voyage over from Western Europe – or else before they're going in the opposite direction. The Portuguese had Macau before, and the British wanted something similar. And so that was one of the demands that they made after the conclusion of the First Opium War in the Treaty of Nanjing in 1842. And that's then sort of reified over various renegotiations in the 19th century.
How long does the Qing Empire hold up under these circumstances?
the Qing Empire ends up falling in 1911 for reasons that I think are connected to Western imperialism, but not solely because of Western imperialism. And I think it's important that we recognize that, the transformations that happened to China over the course of the 19th century are related to Western imperialism, but aren't solely from Western imperialism. Western imperialism, I'd argue, is sort of one factor in a much larger constellation of challenges that the Qing court faced in the 19th century, whether it's through rebellion, whether it's through demographic problems, whether it's through instability on border regions. The foreign powers and their demands for concessions were one factor, an important factor, and became increasingly important over the course of the 19th century. But it is one factor, I would say.
How homogeneous is the Chinese population? Is there ethnic strife in this large country?
There is, to some extent, and that's particularly true. It's particularly true in the Qing, because the Qing dynasty is the last dynasty of China, which lasts from 1644 when they conquer the Ming dynasty until 1911 with the Chinese Revolution. The Qing dynasty was a dynasty that was ethnically Manchu, so groups of it was a minority group, a minority ethnicity from northeast China, the area of Manchuria today. So the Manchu people controlled the area that we know as China and created over the course of their time in the imperial court, they created a large-scale multi-ethnic empire. They conquered large amounts of territory. The Qing Empire was larger than any other previous imperial dynasty and, as I said, it was one of the largest empires in the world in the 18th century. And so they controlled these areas out into the far west. Areas that we know of today as Xinjiang or of Tibet or Mongolia, these areas are conquered or annexed by the Qing and incorporated into their empire in the 18th century. And it is a multi-ethnic empire. That said, the largest population within the Qing Empire were what we call Han Chinese today.
About what, 90% or something?
Yeah, it's 90% or so of the total population. That's one of 56 minorities, but it's by far the largest in modern day China today, and I think we can say the same was true in the Qing Dynasty.
How do U.S.-China relations change with the fall of the Qing Dynasty in 1911?
I think we can see. So we talked about the role of the United States sort of working very closely with the British and with the other imperial powers in the 19th century. You see a really economy-centric sort of policy by the Qing, by the United States, into the late 19th century. And one of the things that we haven't talked about, which is an important moment when we think about sort of foreign imperialism in China, is what's the so-called scramble for concessions, which is in the late 19th century, in which you had foreign imperial powers that are carving off Chinese territory, creating spheres of influence. The United States plays a different sort of role in this. They're not engaged in this process of seizing their own territory, but rather advocate for what they call the open door policy in 1899. The open door policy is essentially saying, we demand to have certain kinds of demand the opportunity to be able to trade in China. To keep those sort of opportunities open. So whether or not we're seizing certain amounts of territory, we're sort of advocating for a position in which the door will be open to all powers that want to trade in China. So this is the larger policy for the United States in the 1890s. It's not backed up by much by anything really.
No treaties for it.
No, it's no treaties. It's the open door policy is laid out in the open door notes, which is just distributed to the other imperial powers. But it's largely supported by the other imperial powers. But I think one of the important sort of the open door policy in 1899, 1900 is an important element of American policy toward China. But I think what's also important for China, for the American policy toward China, is the expansion of the American empire into the Pacific. And so whether it's through the occupation of the Philippines or Puerto Rico or various islands in the Pacific, the expansion of the United States into the Pacific sort of allows the United States to play a much more forward role in East Asia in ways that they didn't before. While previously they had been largely reliant on the British Navy, for example, to sort of advocate for and to carry out American interests. By the early 1900s, the United States has a much more direct sort of role to play. But I'd say that, you know, coming back to your question, it's sort of a long-winded way of getting back to your question, but in 1911, really through the 1920s, the United States is trying to not play an active role in Chinese politics, is wanting to retain certain economic opportunities without being heavily engaged in a very complex political situation in China. China had basically no central government from 1915 until 1927. There's a succession of warlord governments that are coming to power. The United States is sort of involved with many of these regimes and trying to sign trade agreements and be engaged with these regimes in one capacity or another. But the larger policy of the United States is the open door policy, allowing for American trade to continue and allowing for American merchants to be able to continue to engage in the China trade. And this is in the context of a much larger effort by the imperial powers to assert control over China. And Japan in particular, by the 19-teens, becomes much more aggressive in seeking out and staking out economic claims to China. The United States is trying to grapple with the growing power of Japan in the 19-teens and 1920s.
We'll look further at empire building and how it affected U.S.-China relations in the 20th century when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Judd Kinsley, who is telling us about the history of the relations between the United States and China. And we've come into the early 20th century in that saga where we find China, after many, many years of relatively stable dynasties, the Qing dynasty being the last, beginning to become unstable in the early years of the 20th century, arguably to the advantage of the colonial powers, the United States and others? And would that include the famous Boxer Rebellion?
Certainly. The Boxer Rebellion, just to give a little bit of background, the Boxer Rebellion is the Boxers that are named in the rebellion are a series of martial arts groups in North China.
They literally are Boxers.
They're literally Boxers, yeah. So they're martial artists who are embracing sort of semi-magic forms of movements that they believed would repel swords and bullets. And they embraced a sort of anti-foreign, anti-imperialist perspective on, you know, the situation in China in the 19th century. So while you had some reformers in the Qing Empire who were saying, well, we need more reforms along Western lines in order to save the Qing Empire, there's other elements and these sort of certain elements in society were much more resistant to bringing in some of those reforms. So these Boxer groups essentially embraced an anti-foreign policy, I would say, or an anti-foreign position. And they went through North China countryside beating up and killing Christian missionaries, Christian converts, tearing up railroad lines, cutting down telegraph lines. There's several incidents in which they clash with members of foreign embassies. There's a famous incident with a German ambassador, a consular official is killed. And ultimately, these Boxer groups come together in Beijing and lay siege to the embassies in the city of Beijing in order to relieve the siege on Beijing. An eight-nation army comes together. So I'm not going to list all of the nations, but basically all of the imperial powers come together to relieve the siege. And so they attack the Boxers who are laying siege to the embassy, ultimately lifting that siege. These armies then occupy the Forbidden City and force on the Qing Empire a new treaty. And part of this treaty was the Boxer Indemnity. And so this large-scale indemnity, 450 million ounces of silver, I think, was imposed on the Qing Empire, a massive sum for the Qing, impossible to pay back. And I think according to the payment schedule or something, the indemnity wouldn't be fully paid back until 1942 or something.
A bad time to finish paying a debt.
Right, exactly. I think one of the interesting things about that indemnity is the role – I mean, first, the indemnity was incredibly destructive for the Qing from a financial perspective and really wrecks the Qing economy and leads in many ways, I think, towards the – allows – it means that the Qing is not able to respond to many of the problems that are coming up in that first decade of the 20th century, and in some ways allows them less flexibility in ways that probably helps facilitate the downfall of the dynasty in 1911. But I do think that there's another thinking about the U.S.-China relationship. There's another important element of the Boxer Indemnity beyond sort of its destructive power for the Qing. And that is that the indemnity was used by the United States to fund scholarships for Chinese students to
in
come
to China or in the U.S.?
In the United States. So to fund Chinese students to come to the United States. And so a large number, I should say, in fact, we're here on the University of Wisconsin campus, a large number of the students who come to the United States to study at universities like the University of Wisconsin. There's several University of Wisconsin, the Chinese University of Wisconsin students who are funded through the Boxer Indemnity Program. So large numbers of the students who come over to the United States in the first half of the 20th century are funded through this specific program. So I think beyond its destructive power, there's an important sort of legacy for the Boxer Indemnity that's worth it for us to keep in mind.
Well, after the fall of the Qing Dynasty, 1911, who's running the country? And you have this foreign intervention during the Boxer Rebellion, but what stability comes out of it and what is the relationship with the United States?
Well, there's not much. I mean, the last years of the Qing are fairly tumultuous. What you see emerging is a growing disillusionment within China about the Manchu Qing court and sort of new discussions about the extent or the need for very deep kinds of reforms to the Qing and to the Chinese monarchy, the dynastic system. But then at the same time, you also have a new generation of revolutionaries who are saying that the only solution for China is to overthrow the Qing and to bring in a new regime, a new republic. A republic, right. And so many of these revolutionaries are ones who have – and I should say actually reformers too – have deep ties to the United States. Sun Yat-sen himself spent significant amounts of time in Hawaii, which is not a state at this particular moment, but is
U.S. territory.
It is U.S. territory, exactly. So Sun Yat-sen has deep ties to the United States. And ultimately, many of these individuals are traveling to the United States to raise money among Chinese American communities along the West Coast, but throughout the United States. And actually, at the time of the 1911 revolution, when this revolution emerges that had been, you know, supported and kind of ideologically driven in some ways by Dr. Sun Yat-sen, he's actually in the United States raising money for the revolutionary movement at the time of that revolution. And so I think that there's really deep kind of connections between the revolutionary movement and Chinese American communities in the United States more generally in around the time of the revolution in 1911.
Sun Yat-sen and company succeed in establishing a Republic of China?
I mean, I suppose it depends on how you say succeed. The Republic of China is founded in 1912, and Sun Yat-sen is the interim president of that republic. He's shortly pushed out, or he resigns his position in favor of a former Qing official, Yuan Shikai, who comes in and establishes himself pretty quickly as a strong man. He continues to sit as the president of this new republic, but becomes pretty disillusioned with the idea of a republic in China because of an ongoing weakness, the failure to be able to centralize the Chinese state. The revolution is not really successful in and of itself in creating a strong and powerful China. And as a result, then, Yuan Shikai is the president of a fairly weak republic. In the end, he chooses to crown himself the emperor, which is a short-lived monarchy, doesn't end with his death, but he dies the monarchy ends and he dies shortly thereafter. And after that, in the 19-teens, there's a significant amount of political turmoil in China as you have various warlord regimes that essentially set themselves up as being the new head of this Republic of China. So the Republic of China exists, but there's a significant amount of political instability within the Republic of China. So there's really a vacuum at the center of power. You have, as I said, warlord regimes who are all grappling for control of the central government in China at the time.
Is there a central government by the time the Japanese start their incursions into Manchuria in 1931?
There is. So much of the way the historians tend to talk about this is that from this period of Yuan Shikai's death in 1916, until the rise of Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalist Party in 1927. You have this. That's the period, the warlord period in China. That tends to be the way we talk about it in the field of Chinese history. But by 1927, you have a new regime that comes to power under Chiang Kai-shek, the Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang. The Nationalist Party itself was founded by Sun Yat-sen. He had died already. He died in 1925 before 1927, and the ability of the Nationalist Party to undertake, you know, the unification of China, more or less. But there was a stable government in power in 1927, 1928 under Chiang Kai-shek, based in the city of Nanjing in central China.
What kind of relations between the United States and China at this point then?
Chiang Kai-shek comes to power on a wave of sort of nationalistic sentiment. And for him, there's a certain amount of frustration. As I said earlier, one of the elements of American policy toward China had long been kind of seeking out certain kinds of economic opportunities and working very closely with the Western imperial powers, but at the same time embracing a rhetoric that suggests that the United States was different than the Western imperial powers. It was not a colonial country in the same kind of way. There was a certain amount of frustration by Qing officials and later Republican officials as well about this, what they saw to be the United States essentially talking out of both sides of its mouth. On the one hand, sort of embracing colonial or semi-colonial policies in China, seeking out economic opportunity, economic exploitation, but at the same time embracing this very sort of gauzy rhetoric about the American ideal. So Chiang Kai-shek comes to power and is quite frustrated, or he expresses his frustration with American policy. And the United States, for its part, is not really this is a moment of isolation in isolationism in American history. So the idea of large-scale American support for foreign regimes was not something that the United States was very supportive of. And this is particularly true given the fact that, you know, Japan was on the ascendance in East Asia at the time.
So concern about riling up Japan.
Right, exactly. I mean, America had interest in East Asia. And there's a fear that if they rile up or provoke Japan in certain kind of ways, then Japan might, you know, seek to roll back the American empire in the Philippines. And so there's a desire in some ways to be conciliatory towards Japan. And that means not, you know, actively supporting Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalist regime really until the late 1930s.
Well, by the time the late 1930s come around, Japan is pretty well entrenched in significant hunks of China. The United States by this point getting less concerned about riling up Japan? I mean, because one domino after another falls
right
to the Japanese.
I mean, there's a concern about Japan's growing power in East Asia, you know, stretching back to the early 1930s, to the 1920s and the 1930s, sort of a belief that Japan was a direct threat to American interests in East Asia, whether it's trade in China or whether it's American imperial holdings in the Philippines or in the Pacific. So there's a growing set of concerns about Japan already. But even into the, you know, you mentioned the Mukden incident and the seizing of Manchuria in 1931. The United States, it talks a good game, but doesn't really back it up with any real consequences for Japan's seizure of Manchuria. And so the United States, I think, will continue to voice its support for maintaining China's territorial integrity, but it's not really willing to do much beyond that. And there's various efforts to support Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalist Party regime in the late 1930s, but there are also efforts to ensure that it doesn't cross any Japanese red lines out of a fear that would lead to a Japanese response that would undermine American interests. And I think that's an important part of this story. And Chiang Kai-shek, with failing to secure certain kinds of support from the United States, actually ends up receiving significant amounts of support from Nazi Germany in the mid-1930s. That sort of support from Nazi Germany and then later from the Soviet Union is later supplanted by the United States. But there is a fear on the American side about provoking Japan.
And once Pearl Harbor happens, the United States is in a war with Japan. Immediately, China becomes an ally?
Yeah.
And if so, what can America do to help China with Japan having it in its clutches?
Yeah. I think it's right to say immediately. I mean, there's stories about Chiang Kai-shek hearing about the bombing of Pearl Harbor and celebrating, understanding that this changed the calculation for China in its war with Japan. Because I think we have to remember that the war in the United States, the war for the United States begins on December 7th, 1941. But for China, it begins in July of 1937. So China has already been fighting Japan for 4 years before the American entry into the war. And so for Chiang Kai-shek, he sees the American entry into the war as being his salvation. And that's sort of the light at the end of the tunnel for him. And so almost immediately in January of 1942, they signed the United Nations agreement. And Chiang Kai-shek is one of the central powers of that agreement and is seen to be an important player in the United Nations alliance, so the Allied alliance. As you say, I mean, the question is what type of support does China need? And I think one of the frustrations on the China side is that despite the fact that they are that China is held up as being one of the big three, whether it's the Soviet Union, the United States, the Soviet Union, and the United Kingdom, so big four, I guess, that support for Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalists doesn't entirely happen to the extent that Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalist Party was hoping for. From the very beginning of the war, President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill agreed to a Europe First policy in which, you know, the United States will devote its resources toward winning the war in Europe first and then turn its attention towards Asia. Well, that means, in effect, that the material support for China would be secondary to the war in Europe. And you see a number of cases in which China is asking for certain kinds of material support from the United States, whether it's in the form of certain kinds of aircraft or weapons or other kinds of industrial goods that are being shipped out to China. But that is often directed back towards Europe, much to the frustration of Chinese officials who say that we've been fighting this war for much longer than anybody else and we need more support than you're giving us. And so there's real tensions from the beginning, really from the beginning of the U.S.-China alliance over the question of military support for the Chinese regime. The United States tries to hold the line and not provide too much material, but also to say the right things to keep China in the war. Well, China says, well, we need more, and if we don't get more, then our regime potentially could fall, or maybe we'll feel the need to surrender to Japan. So you see this kind of ongoing tensions between China and the United States over this question of military aid. And that's sort of the centerpiece of American support for China, particularly in the early years of the war, is military aid. I mean, one thing we haven't talked about yet, but is the question of how to get that aid there. I mean,
well, yeah, logistics, it's right. A long way.
It's a long way, absolutely. And interestingly, I mean, the Pacific was, in the early years of the war, was not open to American convoys. So much of the American material aid to China was going the opposite direction, so around the Horn of Africa from the Atlantic. But the question even beyond that was how to get it into China, because the China coast was largely closed by the Japanese after 1938. So you did have certain amounts of material aid that were flowing into China via the Burma Road from Rangoon. But in 1942, at the same time, or shortly after Japan bombs Pearl Harbor, they also undertake a campaign in Burma. And so the port at Rangoon is closed, the Burma Road is closed, and Burma is largely occupied. So that means that much of the American military aid then is flown into China via the so-called hump route over the Himalayan mountains.
Right.
So flown in from airfields in northeast India.
A plane can carry only so much, though,
exactly.
Compared to a train or even a convoy of trucks.
Exactly. And that's sort of an ongoing problem for American officials, is how to provide China with the type of support that it needs, at the same time without sort of completely overtaxing the larger logistical systems that are in place. And so what you see happening, and I've written about this a little bit, is that you see, you know, these massive stockpiles that are building up in India just because, as you say, I mean, the the inside of a C-47 is relatively small, and there's only so many flights that can go in a given day, and so the amounts of material are pretty heavily restricted, and so this only compounds the larger problems of China, which is demanding, just to keep itself in the war and to keep its head above water, demanding certain kinds of support that the United States is in some ways is unwilling to provide. Unwilling to provide the amount that they want, but also they are unable to provide just given the complex logistics of supply.
We're going to look at China, communist China, after World War II and coming into the 21st century, time permitting, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Judd Kinsley, who's walking us through a history of U.S.-Chinese relations. And the United States and China, understandably, were allies during World War II and the Japanese occupation of much of Japan. And then around, 1945, end of World War II, things changed pretty radically as we go to Mao Zedong.
Yeah, I think you could say that. I mean, I think we need to back up a little and think a little bit about the American interaction with the Chinese Communist Party, which is the current ruling party in China today, because I think some of the knee-jerk reaction against communism and socialism that we see in the Cold War era, you don't necessarily see it as clearly in the latter years of the war, even. And there's pretty deep contacts in the United States and interest in the Chinese Communist Party experiment in North China during the war years. And so even figures like Joseph Stilwell, an American military figure, were interested and were less sort of opposed potentially to the idea of even arming the Chinese Communist Party, which was at the time was already being headed by Mao Zedong. And so I think that there was less skepticism about the Chinese Communist Party. And there's actually some active support for the Chinese Communist Party by members of the U.S. State Department, members of the U.S. military command in China, who held up the Chinese Communist Party as a foil in many ways to the Nationalist Party, which had major problems with corruption, authoritarianism in the latter years of the war. And so, to some extent, for Americans in China, there was a possibility that the Chinese Communist Party was something quite different. It was perhaps a more effective political institution than the Nationalist Party was, and that's pretty clear that there was significant amounts of support for the Chinese Communist Party among certain people within the American governmental establishment in the 1940s. That does change, though, in the latter years of the war, and it particularly changes after the war when the prospect of fighting with the Nationalists of the civil war between the Chinese Communist Party and the Nationalist Party becomes much more clear, and also with Soviet territorial gains in Eastern Europe, and so the specter of Stalin and the Soviet and the so-called Iron Curtain seems to point to territorial ambitions for Stalin and the Soviet Union that China seemed to be a part of in the late 1940s, and so seeing the seizure of Eastern Europe. Many in the United States began to see the rise of the Chinese Communist Party and the successes of the Chinese Communist Party against the Nationalist Party during the Chinese Civil War, which directly succeeded the war in the Pacific. All that seemed to point to the rising power of the Soviet Union. And so you see this pretty sharp shift in American government policy away from any kind of engagement with the Chinese Communist Party toward a much more sort of aggressive policy of confronting the Chinese Communist Party. There's still sort of discussion among American scholars in the United States about whether or not this sort of shift alienated China in ways that would lead toward the 20 years of tensions that the 30 years of tensions that we would see after the Chinese Revolution in 1949, and whether there was a lost chance for the United States to be able to engage with Mao and the Chinese Communist Party had we sort of formed a diplomatic or kind of economic relationship with them earlier.
That's something we've seen that kind of thing before in other countries, haven't we? Like maybe Iran or
sure.
Cuba, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there are reasons to be skeptical about the extent to which Mao and the Chinese Communist Party might have been open to the idea of a closer relationship with the United States. Mao, I think, without question, was a communist and believed in communist ideology. And he said very explicitly at various points, you know, that they leaned to one side, they leaned to the Soviet side. But at the same time, it is clear that the United States also did have this sort of 180-degree shift away from engagement towards opposition, and that creates certain kinds of tensions, I think, that ultimately do lead toward this policy of confrontation with the United States at the latter years of the Chinese Civil War and immediately following the victory of the Chinese Communist Party in 1949. And I should say, taking it one year farther, with the outbreak of the Korean War, in which Chinese forces are fighting against American forces
directly
in the Korean Peninsula.
Dramatically, too.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
U.S.-China relations pretty much in freeze mode till 1972?
I think you could say that. The United States, the China, I think both sides view the other with suspicion and use the other for their own political purposes.
Fear-mongering.
Exactly. And I think that's certainly the case in China. In China, they're holding up the menace of American imperialism in order to mobilize loyalty for the Chinese Communist Party regime, mobilize loyalty for the People's Republic. And the same is true in the United States. We see that through things like the Red Scare and through mobilizing sort of anti-communist sentiment for political gain. So I think both sides are really doing that. And the result is a real kind of diplomatic freeze between the two sides from 1949 up until 1972.
What prompted Richard Nixon to recognize China, communist China, as the one China?
Well, a lot of it has to do, again, with – and I think the same is true in China. Well, a lot of it is with my understanding that America has domestic politics. And so to some extent, foreign policy is a way to find a way out of the Vietnam War from American perspective, but also to sort of have Nixon be viewed as
a statesman,
a brilliant strategist, what have you. And this is sort of cooked up almost certainly by Henry Kissinger, who has this kind of vision for what the administration could do. But I think the same is true for China as well. Internal political factions in China, there was an effort through internal factional fighting in the latter years of the Cultural Revolution. There is an opportunity for Mao to be able to sideline certain political competitors for power by embracing or by reaching out to the United States. So I think in the U.S.-China relationship from 1949 to 1972 is shaped in a lot of ways by domestic politics as much as they are the international situation.
And warm and cool ever since, would you say, off and on, relations between the United States and China?
Throughout that period from 1949 to?
Well, from 72 on.
Oh, from 72 on. I mean, I think you have – it is a little warm and cold. And I think that part of that is before Mao's death, there is kind of a grappling for power in China. And the question was, are these sort of the left elements of the Chinese Communist Party that were driving the Cultural Revolution, the most violent aspects of the Cultural Revolution, are they going to be the ones in charge when Mao dies, or is it the sort of more rightist elements within the Chinese Communist Party, represented by Deng Xiaoping or Zhou Enlai and some of these other figures? So that leads to, I suppose you could say a warm and cool policy. But really that's – and there is an interest on the China side of being able to acquire American technology through trade.
Or other means.
Sure. I think that's a later story. But to have open lines of communication that will allow for the import of technology, the import of industrial machinery.
Including consumer goods.
And the other thing is foreign investments. So in the 1980s, you have a larger amount of foreign investment. But I think that sort of the recognition of the need for foreign technology and foreign machinery is one that does prompt some of the opening to the world in the early 1970s and allows for the Chinese regime to see potential opportunities in engagement with the United States. But I think that a lot of the kind of political machinations that are in place in the late 1970s or in the 1970s are not ended with Deng Xiaoping's coming to power and the unveiling of the so-called reform and opening period in 1978, But a lot of that does create a fundamentally new kind of political terrain. It's a indication that some of the Mao's sort of perspective on continuous revolution is one that's being pushed to the wayside. And so there's a discussion about how to use or bring in certain forms of market reforms to reform China's economy, not necessarily to embrace American-style capitalism, but to bring in certain elements of a capitalist economy in order to help improve Chinese economic efficiency and Chinese production in the 1980s. And that's dependent in a lot of ways on engagement with American corporations, with American economic thinkers, with American politicians. There's really deep sort of engagements that are happening in the 1980s.
Status of American-Chinese competition in the early 21st century as China makes noises perhaps about expanding Taiwan, for example, and other parts of the Pacific there adjacent to China. And, of course, all the technological innovations that they're touting.
Mm-hmm.
What's the relationship? How would you describe it at this point?
With the United States? I mean, I think that there's very clear tensions with the United States. It's hard to get around that. I mean, and I think there's a lot of discussion, and there has been over several years about this question of decoupling, right? Decoupling the two economies. I mean, China's been quite involved in the production, explicitly the production of various goods that are being consumed in the United States. And so the question is, you know, how much of that, how
dependent do we want to be on China?
Right. And I think on the Chinese side is how dependent do they want to be on that trade with the United States and maybe forming other kinds of economic relationships. But that's actively being discussed and grappled over, I think. And that's the story of where we are now. I think that there are reasons to think with sort of skepticism or concern about the future. But there's also, I think, that the depth of those economic connections remain powerful. And I think that those kind of economic connections are what sort of maintain a certain amount of or allow for that U.S.-China relationship to not spin too far into overt confrontation, because there's a sort of a mutual recognition of the need for kind of that economic relationship over time. And I think that's important for us to remember and to keep in mind.
Judd Kinsley, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure for me too.
Kind of a run through U.S.-Chinese relations, which continue to develop in the 21st century. I'm Norman Gilliland. Our engineer is Tom Blaine, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.